As always, we need to take a moment to thank our sponsors, who have not only helped us bring you more and more episodes, but have allowed us to host giveaways and events, and they really, really help. They are amazing also, and you need to check them out if you haven't already. I know we talk about them every single episode, but it's very much so worth it. Because one of them's the freaking Baker Street Journal, and it's like the publication. It's what Sherlock Holmes fans read, really. You can find them at bakerstreetjournal.com. It's a quarterly publication. Anyone can submit things, so if you wanted to write an article of some sort, first you need to, send it to us for our book. You can find that info at theonefixpoint.tumblr.com. Just throwing that in there. No, check out the Baker Street Journal. There's all sorts. Ghost Bees now has his art going in every single time, which is fantastic. I'm in the winter issue. The babes are trying to be in every issue from here on out, slowly taking over the world. Also, Wessex Press, which is publishing the One Fixed Point essay collection. You can find them at wessexpress.com. They also publish the journal. And they have all sorts of Sherlock Holmes books. They have the Vincent Starr CD, which is beautiful and everyone should own. They also have a study in celluloid, which is behind the scenes on the Granada productions, written by the producer Michael Cox, which was out of print for a really long time and now it's back. So you should get it because it's back. And also A Scintillation of Science, not scintillation as I pronounced it before because I don't know how to pronounce things apparently. That is a symposium in the summer. First one I ever talked at, which was, it was terrifying, but it was really good. Really good fun. You can find that at scintillation.org, I think. I should know this. I am sorry. Type in Scintillation of Science and it'll come up. I promise. You can also find them on Twitter and Facebook and all the great places. And enjoy the episode.
Oh, they call us the irregulars, but baby, we're always on time. Baker Street babes always leave the rest of them. Scotland Yard, they send you home. You feel like you're losing your mind. If this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you 2-2-1 your mind?
Welcome to episode 37 of the Baker Street Babes. And today we are interviewing Amy, who once again has written a pastiche novel.
Yes, I have. It's called the first book was called The Detective and the Woman, and if you haven't heard that episode, it is in our list. I'm not actually sure what number it is, but this one follows on that. It's called The Detective, the Woman, and the Winking Tree, and Sarah and I are here to talk about that.
So last time that we saw Holmes and Irene, they had exciting adventure and parted ways. This was set during the Great Hiatus. So can you tell us where they are now without spoiling anything? How much later is it? What's going on?
I was, it's funny because I was thinking about that, like, how can I say that without spoiling it? I will say the first book kind of has an epilogue that takes it further. This book takes place before that. It takes place right at the, basically, after the adventure of the first book. So, it's set in the village of Fulworth, which is in the canon, where it's where Sherlock Holmes retires, although he is not yet retired, but Irene is now a resident in that village. And this is taking place post-hiatus, but in the time when Holmes and Watson are still solving cases together, kind of maintaining their normal equilibrium. This is sort of sandwiched at a point where Holmes is getting out of London at the end of a case. He hasn't got another one on yet, and he's coming to Fulworth after he receives a letter from Irene Adler with an interesting mystery in it.
And you can never resist the interesting mysteries.
No.
Right. Obviously, if Holmes is back with Watson, this is after the Great Hiatus.
Yes. Yeah, it actually tells the story of James Fillmore, which is a case mentioned in The Problem of Thor Bridge. Mm-hmm. It's one that a lot of people are interested in and that has been finished in different ways by different people. For me, I was intrigued, as many people are, by the description of the case by Watson, where it's the James Fillmore who goes into his house to retrieve his umbrella and is never seen again. And I decided that I wanted to frame the story as the Fillmore family being a part of Fulworth Village, and that being a situation that Irene Adler finds herself involved in as part of that village. So it's something that she is personally encountering that she actually enlists the help of Holmes to deal with.
So what inspired you to write this second story? Did you have an idea as you were finishing up the first book, or did this come later?
You know, it's funny because I don't know, and I know you, I think you do write some, like, off and on, and it's like, I'm sure you know how it is where you get, like, plot bunnies. Like, you know, it's funny because if you do National Novel Writing Month for real, like, on the website, they have a place where you can actually, like, quote-unquote, leave your plot bunnies, like, so that they don't distract you. And for people who don't know, a plot bunny is when you're writing a book and you know what you're writing about, but you have other ideas rattling around in your head. And if you're not disciplined about it, you can kind of go off on tangents. And that's where you see people kind of working on the same book for years and years. Not that that can't work, but in most cases, people kind of get off on tangents and they never finish because they have too many ideas. And so at some point you have to just set everything else aside and go, okay, this is the story I'm telling. And that was definitely true for me, where I think, you know, obviously Sherlock Holmes is an incredibly rich character. We have, you know, years and years and years of pastiche beyond the canon that people have written. And Irene Adler as well has featured in several stories. As I talked about last time that we did this, my vision of Irene's role in the ongoing life of Sherlock Holmes is not as some kind of, you know, hypersexualized femme fatale. She's more of an intelligent, well-realized person who is a mental equivalent to Holmes, not the same kind of person at all, but someone who can interact with Holmes on his level. And so I felt when I was writing about them the first time that there were a lot of stories I wanted to tell, some of which, though, didn't need to take place until they had already established their friendship, because in the first one, I'm dealing with what happens, how do you even get them back together after a scandal in Bohemia, where they're obviously not, there may be grudging respect there, but they're obviously not allies or friends yet. And so the first book was largely, it was a mystery, but it was also about getting those characters to a point of trust and friendship. And then this book, the story that I wanted to tell, I felt like fit better in a situation where they already know each other somewhat better. So that was kind of, I guess, my inspiration for putting this story where I did, is that it was an idea that I had sort of in a very early version a long time ago, but that I felt like needed to wait until the characters were close to each other, closer to each other at least.
And I really enjoyed that take on Irene that's different from a lot of what we've seen lately, at least.
Thank you.
And so does this mean that you have other ideas percolating that we'll be talking to you about book three in a while?
You know, I think there are a lot of ideas. It's funny because I know that you're also a big Lori R. King fan, actually, and you're the reason that I even know who she is, because through a roundabout pathway you introduced her to someone else who introduced her to me. So, you know, I laugh sometimes with my sister, who's also a big fan of hers, that you can kind of do endless stories if you set them close enough to one another. That, like, if you have sort of, like, what she does with Holmes and Russell, she's obviously post-canon, so she can kind of do whatever she wants time-wise, but it's like you have one end and another one begin very quickly, so that you're not taking up too much time. And I think, because I am still writing at this point at a time when we're still kind of in the middle of the canon, I have to be a little more careful about, you know, Holmes can't spend half the year in Fulworth or he won't be in London for his cases, obviously. But I do have more ideas, and I have more kind of little things that kind of came up as I was writing that I thought, I'd like to take that a little further or something. But for me, because I am the kind of person who tends to start with a very, very broad idea and not really conceptualize it or make it specific until I'm actually writing, I don't like to let myself get too specific before that, because if I do, I'm a little bit attention deficit hyperactive. And if I tell myself the entire story and I have it too specific, then I'm not going to want to write it down, because I'm going to be, I'm going to feel like I've already been there and done that. Now, obviously, writing that way means that you do have edits and extensive things that you're reading back through and refining. But for me, that process works where I kind of go, okay, this is where I want to take it. When I get ready to sit down and write, this is the point I'm going to start at. Maybe this is where I want to finish. And maybe I might have a few signposts in the middle, but as I'm writing, I kind of refine it.
Yeah, I was curious about your writing process, because the first book sort of just fell out of your brain almost, and I guess this one took a little bit longer.
Yeah, I had started it pretty soon after the first one, and I actually, to be honest, have a very, very, very small part of the beginning of book three, just as kind of like a bookmark for my thoughts to say, okay, this is what I was thinking, so I can go back to it later. In this case, obviously, when you have a book out, you've got promotion and you've got time that your kind of attention is taken up with the book that you're working on. And so I didn't want to really knuckle down on the second one until I was sort of through some of the promotional and early aspects of getting the first one out. And then once I sort of decided to really work on it, it took me a little bit to get going again. And what I eventually realized was, okay, I've got to at some point just set myself a time. I'm going to be done with at least the rough draft at this point. And so once I did kind of get that deadline back down, the bulk of the book was done in a quick amount of time, like the first one, but definitely sort of the first half was a little bit longer in the making. And I didn't find, honestly, that there was a huge difference. I didn't find that my writing style or anything like that changed. It's more like, for me personally, one of the easier things about, because of the way I write, that I don't have like extensive outlining beforehand, I find that if I do most of it in a short amount of time, I'm less likely to forget details and contradict myself and things like that. Obviously, you can go back and grab some of that, but it's nice if you don't have like insane amounts of rewriting to do.
So is there anything else you can tell us about this particular case? So Holmes and Watson are in London, with Holmes occasionally coming into the country. You already said how I think it's involved.
I did want to say, because I know all of us on the Baker Street Babes are big Watson fans, because he's awesome.
Yes.
And I did not really feature Watson very much in the first one, although, interestingly, I found that he was sort of hanging over me. Like, I could not help mentioning him regularly and having him be in people's minds, but he didn't feature as a major character, because I kind of felt like, in the case of both Watson and Mycroft, who was mentioned briefly, I needed to really concentrate on Holmes and Irene and develop that sort of their characters and the way that they related without bringing in too many other major characters. In this one, because that relationship is more established and has more of a status quo, I did feel more comfortable bringing in Watson. And I don't have Watson as narrator. This one is similar to the first one in that I go back and forth between chapters that are Irene's first-person perspective and Holmes in a third-person perspective. But you will see Watson in this book, and he does come in as a major character, and he lives up to his many reputations, and I believe, you know, he's a wonderful character in the canon, and I did want to honor that, and I hope that I did, because I think he's just, I couldn't resist bringing in the dynamic of Holmes and Watson, because that's such an ironic, funny thing, but also a touching thing, and such an iconic part of the canon, and I didn't want to get it wrong, which is one of the reasons that I sort of shied away from it at first, but I felt comfortable bringing Watson. He comes into it partway through the book, and he's a big part of it. He's a big part of the case, but he comes into sort of the Fuller situation and adds his own flair to that, which I love. As far as the case itself, I think in the first book, the case is a bit more straightforward. It's very linear. It's very much like, you know, Irene and Holmes find out something, you know, it's very, very linear. This case, I think, has a few more twists and turns. The whole concept of the fact that someone disappeared, it's not a straight up theft or murder or anything like that. It's a missing person. I felt like lent itself to something that had, some layers to it and kind of has the aspect of, making you look at a village and maybe, you know, the underside of what can be happening in a country village. So, it's about sort of, romantic entanglements and deception and, people not seeming like what they actually are.
Intriguing. So you mentioned a minute ago about the voices you write in Irene in the first person and Holmes in the third person. And I was curious about that choice, if it was a choice that you made to write Holmes in the third person or if the characters just sort of presented themselves to you that way.
You know, it's funny because I think it's kind of both and it's kind of in between. I definitely knew that I wanted to write Irene in the first person, the very beginning of the first book where she's standing over her late husband's body. That came to me. That was just, I don't know. It's just one of those things like I guess it's your creative brain. So it seems like it's coming from somewhere random. But as far as writing Holmes, I definitely did consider writing him in the first person. People have done that, you know, with varying degrees of success, but I don't know that it's something I've heard done well very often or something that I would want to maybe dive into if I could help it. I think Holmes is a character in canon, to me at least, who has a certain amount of removal from us. You know, as we, as the Baker Street Babes, talked about on our last episode, I think it was, Holmes is not necessarily the greatest source of talking about himself. And I think the third person, it allows me, I'm not an omniscient narrator in that sense. I am using Holmes's point of view, so he's not going to know things that Holmes wouldn't know or see things that Holmes wouldn't see. But I think it allows me to feel like I preserve that slight amount of distance that we always have with this really fascinating character and allowing us to kind of also see him from other people's perspective through Irene's eyes. I also felt like because Irene is such a relatively minor character, even though she's obviously a character that many people really care about and are interested in, she doesn't appear very much in the canon. You know, she's mentioned in the one story and then she's mentioned a couple of other times, but doesn't appear as a character. And so I felt a little more freedom in looking at her actions that we see in the canon and extrapolating from that, okay, what kind of woman is this? What kind of person is this? I think, in a way, the fact that we have so much more material about Sherlock Holmes made me less want to do that because I would never want to write a Holmes that is far off from the original or is distracting in a way that people would be reading along going, okay, this is not Sherlock Holmes, this is some other character. And obviously, any writer, I think, who's not obviously Sir Arthur Conan Doyle is going to do that to some extent. I think it's impossible to be Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, but I think that the third person for me helps me to feel like I'm not murdering what has already been created. And for the second book, I just naturally, for me, it was just a continuation of, even though it doesn't take up right where the other one left off, there's some time elapsing where Irene is getting more comfortable in the village. Holmes is post-hiatus getting back to his regular life. But for me, in terms of the characters, it felt like it was taking up where it left off. So it was natural for me to write in that same format again. The book is available at Amazon.com, Amazon.co.uk. It's available as a print book and an ebook. You can also get it through Barnes & Noble and BarnesandNoble.com. And the Book Depository Worldwide, that's they have free shipping to, like, almost every country, so that's a really good option. And then my publisher is MX Publishing, and you can get it off mxpublishing.com, or you can link to the respective websites for wherever you happen to be, and it's available there as well.
And if anyone is curious about Amy's first book, we talked to her in episode 24 about that book.
Thank you. And that book is also available the same way. It's available on the Amazons and Book Depository and Barnes & Noble. I will say that book stands alone, and this book stands alone as well. It's one of those things where they are connected, and it's great if you've read the first one, but if you want to jump into the second one, there's nothing that would prohibit you from doing that. They're not linked to the point that you won't know what's going on or anything. And there's a certain amount of recapping just in the fact that jumping back into the story when you have Irene thinking about her current life situation, that gives you a little bit of background on. I did also want to say, if people are members of Goodreads, there is a giveaway, and it's got a couple more days on it. So if you look up The Detective, the Woman, and the Winking Tree on Goodreads.com, you can enter to win that for free. And you can also see other people's reviews and experiences with both of the books. So you can kind of make a more informed decision. I think Goodreads is a great way to do that.
All right.
And Sarah and I wanted to mention a couple of other sort of things that you guys might be interested in. One is that if you want to continue to be a part of the Save Undershaw campaign, which is the movement to help save and restore Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's home. The Undershaw Preservation Trust is running a competition, and what it is they're inviting fans to write about how the campaign inspires them, your motivations for why you would want to save the home. And the winning entries will be published. They're planning to publish 221 of them. Get it? 221B. And so you have a good chance of being published if you decide to enter. The entries should be between 500 and 600 words, and you just email those to project221@hotmail.com. That's just the word project and then the numbers 221@hotmail.com. And then, Sarah, do you want to mention our other item on the agenda?
Yes. The Babes are also collecting essays for a book that will be published hopefully in the fall. It will be titled The One Fixed Point in a Changing Age, Essays on Sherlockiana by Online Fandom. And so this is, there are so many amazing writers out there with wonderful thoughts and essays that we post on Tumblr and all of our blogs. But we don't really have a published body of work. And so the goal is to get all of you and your wonderful thoughts all together in one place. And information about that is on the Tumblr and also at theonefixedpoint.tumblr.com. So check out that information, and I believe the deadline is March 1st for submissions. So if you have some ideas that you want to get on paper and possibly get published, you should get on that as quickly as possible.
Yes, and I am actually the one that's manning the Tumblr, so if you have questions, that's something that we check regularly, daily. So if you have any questions about the frequently asked questions or the issues with the submission guidelines, just drop us a private message, and we will get back to you right away. Everybody should go to 221bcon.
Yeah. I think I'm actually going to be free that weekend, so I should do that. I thought I was going to be in Delaware, probably, but I won't be.
Oh, good. Oh, good. Yeah, I'm actually going to be there, which I'm really excited about. I'm going to Stitches and...
Yarn!
I know. I'm going to be like Yarn and then Sherlock. I'm going to be like, what am I doing?
Yeah, I'm on a yarn diet, so...
Oh, bless your heart. Just be on it until April. 221bcon is April 13th and 14th in Atlanta, Georgia. And several of the Baker Street Babes are going to be there. And we are supposed to be recording a podcast live, which I'm kind of amazed and apprehensive and excited about all at the same time. But if you have a burning desire to meet a Baker Street Babe, there will be some there. And it will actually be my first time to meet several of the Baker Street Babes in person, which I'm very excited about. So.
Yes, I don't think I've met any of you in person.
Mm-hmm. No, I feel like I know you all really well. But
exciting.
Yay!
If this quotidian world has got you crying, want you to